A private school in Northern Virginia's Fairfax County wants to expand to serve more students, and it needs the county's approval. Not a big deal, usually. But this school is Islamic and funded by the government of Saudi Arabia. So what began as a local land use issue has grown into a broader discussion of the school, its teachings, and the relationships between Muslims and non-Muslims in this country. NPR's Jamie Tarabay has the story.
This story begins last summer. And to hear Pat Herity tell it, this is a story about traffic.
You can't drive Pope's Head Road. You can't look at Pope's Head Road. You can't. I couldn't imagine putting another car per 6 seconds on the Pope's Head Road.
We're standing at the front of a driveway with a white picket gate. Beyond the driveway, up a hill, past the security guard, shaded by tall trees, is the ISA, the Islamic Saudi Academy. In August, the county's Board of Supervisors approved the academy's bid to expand its campus and double the number of students who come here to about 500. This gate is the only entry and exit point.
They say they want them to use this exit up here, come down this way, but they have to make a left-hand turn into here. Guess which way the commuters are coming in the morning?
Herity is the supervisor for the Springfield District. He voted against the bid. This is his area. He graduated from a local high school, and the people who live here are his constituents. As we're talking, Beth Parker, who's lived next door for 33 years, is driving by, but she pulls over when she spots Herity. She complains that since the academy got its approval, no one's cut the grass.
Look at the maintenance of the place. I cannot tell you what we've gone through ever since they've owned it to try to get them to maintain the fence to where it's relevant to the neighborhood, keeping the land mowed and neat looking. And they did it all during this process. And once they got it, you can see what it looks like now.
She's mad that politics got in the way of what she says is strictly a land use issue. But scratch the surface, and it becomes very clear, very quickly, that this is about more than traffic.
Wahhabist Sharia compliant institution.
This is what happened when the board met to discuss the academy's application. People lined up for hours to speak at public hearings.
And what are the results of the health department's action item from the last planning commission about an assessment of the septic system?
That's John Cosgrove, who began his speaking time asking about the septic system at the campus. He ended it with this.
Because I submit no Catholic textbook has anything near the venom and demonstrated incitement to murder as these Islamic Saudi textbooks. Rather than rushing to congratulate them for what they've removed, why don't we ask them the fundamental question of what was it doing there for 20 years in the first place?
Thank you, Mr. Cosgrove.
This went on for hours, people first bringing up traffic issues, then invariably turning the talk towards religion. People travelled from other states to speak. Conservative Christian groups got involved. And it put the people who send their kids to the school on the defensive. People like Razan Fayez, whose 7-year-old son goes there.
He can speak, read, and write Arabic almost as well as he can English. He's learning Islamic studies, understanding of respect between Muslims and non-Muslims. If we were breeding terrorists, if there was any little tinge of truth to anything that these people have been saying before, you would be hearing about it because of the students.
Iman Kandil, a former ISA student and MIT graduate, also spoke up.
In addition to the strong background in math and science that I got at ISA, the greatest lessons that I've learned at ISA are those of community service and giving back. We are not taught to enforce Sharia law. We are not taught to destroy the Constitution.
But there are issues. A former valedictorian is serving a life sentence convicted of plotting to assassinate President Bush. A former principal was arrested because instead of reporting a complaint from one of his students about sexual abuse at home, he deleted the report and returned the child to her father. And there are the textbooks.
These are ideological material that are indoctrinating young students in hatred.
Ali Ahmed, a Saudi dissident, works for the Gulf Institute. He's been studying the ISA's curriculum for nearly 10 years. He flips through one of the Islamic studies textbooks.
This is 10th grade. If you are not a believer in their interpretation of the religion, you are not protected. Your blood, your honor, your property, is up for grabs. And that explains the suicide bombing a lot, because how do you convince somebody to walk into a crowded market and blow themselves up? Because these people, their life worth is zero.
In 2007, a bipartisan Federal Commission on International Religious Freedom called for the school to be shut while the government examined its textbooks. It was concerned the school promoted religious intolerance and violence against people who aren't Muslim. The school responded by erasing paragraphs from textbooks. The ISA had initially agreed to let NPR visit its campus, but cancelled at the last minute. An email said the school administrators were tired of all the media coverage and didn't want any more, especially since they got the approval to expand. So for now, the controversy continues, and so does the pressure on local politicians. Michael Fry is on the board of supervisors. He voted yes and says he still cops heat for that. One man came up to him at a local supermarket on a Sunday morning after Fry had taken his dog for a walk.
He said, "I can't believe that you voted that way, and you call yourself a conservative." And he tried to get a little aggressive, and I said, "First of all, let me just say, I don't believe that anybody who wants local government to be reading texts and making decisions on schools based on what they teach is a conservative." I said, "To me, that is one of the biggest intrusions you could possibly imagine."
The State Department agrees. Conservative Christian groups who've lobbied for the school to be closed say because it's funded by the Saudi government, the State Department should intervene. But the State Department says it's a private school, not a foreign mission, and it has no role in accrediting or managing the ISA. Fry points out that two Christian schools also filed applications to expand last year. No one questioned their textbooks.
How do I know that this Christian school isn't teaching hatred against non-Christians? I said, I didn't read their text, but if you want me to start to base land use decisions on those, terribly, terribly slippery slope.
For now, Fairfax County's waiting for the school to submit its site plans. Before expansion can even begin at the academy, the county will have to install left and right turns into the driveway from Pope's Head Road. So that two-lane winding country road will get a little wider. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Well, one small silver lining of the recession may be that it underscored just how little some Americans understand personal finance. That presents a golden opportunity to change the way young people learn about money. And some credit unions want to play an increasing role in teaching that curriculum. From member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina, Scott Graff reports.
A recent 10-year survey conducted by Finesse Financial found that 86% of Americans don't know if they're on track to retire comfortably, and 43% said they spend more than they make each month. People like Glenda Head are working to change those kind of stats. It's 11:30, and Head, a business teacher, is walking to the lunchroom at R.B. Glenn High School near Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Once there, she helps two of her students open the school's branch of a legacy federal credit union. It's one of four the nonprofit has started at area high schools.
They have to sign into a safe log where we sign in and out every day. So the beginning balance and the ending balance is confirmed.
Soon, the day's first customer, Jasmine, approaches the counter.
I'm withdrawing money from my account. $10 to be exact.
From savings, checkings.
Make that 15.
One of the two tellers working today is 17-year-old Austin Dodd. He says the class that goes along with this hands-on experience is already paying off for him.
I'm actually saving up money now, and if I wouldn't have, I guess, got into this, I'd probably still be spending my money as soon as I get it.
Dodd and his classmates are introduced to things like credit scores, the stock market, and mortgages. Students are taught about ARMs versus fixed mortgages, why a 15-year is better than a 30, and the importance of making extra payments. Getting young people involved with credit unions is not a new idea. According to the Credit Union National Association, there were more than 700 branches in schools and youth clubs in 34 states last year. What has changed is the pace of growth. Since 2007, the number of these has increased by one-third.
Oh, student-run credit unions are fabulous.
That's Laura Levine, who heads the Washington, D.C.-based Jumpstart Coalition. Its mission is to get kids thinking about money matters as early as kindergarten. And her job is getting easier. She says the recession has sparked a dialogue about the importance of teaching kids a very basic life skill, one she says was once routinely taught.
We got away from some of the practical matters. I think we now realize that maybe we swung the pendulum a little too far away from the practical stuff.
While just about everyone who learns of the student-run credit union seems to like them, Sandy Wheat says they won't solve financial illiteracy. She's with the North Carolina Council on Economic Education and says the reality is that they're used by only a tiny fraction of high school students. And she says implementing such programs nationwide poses big challenges.
The idea of bringing in banking services to them is a little bit of a far-fetched notion when they're not even performing to grade level expectations in their reading and math skills.
Wheat says funding the programs may be unrealistic at a time when school budgets are so tight. But she says the more young people can learn about money in school, the better their chances of avoiding the financial pitfalls facing so many adults today. For NPR News, I'm Scott Graff in Charlotte.
While the administration is proposing a freeze for most government programs, education spending would get a healthy bump. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the White House is using the budget to push its agenda for the nation's schools.
The White House wants the education budget to rise about 7% in fiscal year 2011. Most of that money would be directed toward elementary and secondary education. Now, some of the funds would go into traditional programs that address poverty or focus on learning disabled children, but a big chunk, $1.5 billion, will go into a competitive grant program called the Race to the Top Fund. If you've heard of it, it's because that's all the education secretary talks about these days. Race to the Top is already sending over $4 billion to states that agree with the White House on how to fix education. Jack Jennings of the Center on Education Policy says the president's agenda would be a big shift away from awarding grants automatically.
But what he's doing is causing a shift so that some money and some significant amounts of money would be available only if there was change.
We've seen that change already. Many states have relaxed rules on charter schools or changed the way teachers are evaluated in order to get federal funding. The new budget also lays out a roadmap for altering the No Child Left Behind law. The White House wants to do away with some of the punishments that struggling schools have faced. The new law, if Congress goes along, would reward success and encourage states to raise achievement standards. Here again, the administration is using money as a carrot. The White House says it would seek up to $1 billion in additional funding if Congress comes up with a bill that the White House likes. But the administration's new proposals could just complicate the effort to reauthorize this controversial education law. Congress has tried at this and failed before. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Between 1940 and 1960, one high school in St. Louis produced a Wimbledon champ, two Rock and Roll Hall of Famers, an Emmy-winning actor, and a famous comedian and activist. Back then, Sumner High School was an educational jewel, anchoring a thriving middle-class black neighborhood. But Sumner's status as the first black high school west of the Mississippi won't protect it from closure if academics and student behavior don't improve soon. As St. Louis Public Radio's Rachel Lipman reports, that's prompted some alarmed alumni to try to save the school they love.
The end of third period at Sumner High School sends its 550 students streaming through a building where Arthur Ashe, Tina Turner, Chuck Berry, Robert Guillaume, and Dick Gregory once attended classes. Cornell Andrews is wearing a maroon sweatshirt identifying him as an alum and is helping teachers monitor the controlled chaos in the hallways. This is the first time Andrews has actively participated in something with the Alumni Association since he graduated in 1976.
When I attended school here, there was a great deal of school pride. When it was mentioned that the school might be closing, that was just devastating to most alumni.
The Sumner that Andrews remembers had a lot of clubs, a student council, and a marching band. Today, there are a few extracurriculars beyond sports. Just 30% of Sumner students read at grade level. Just 10% can do grade level math. Sumner's academic problems aren't unique among urban districts. The St. Louis public schools are under state control for that very reason. So Superintendent Kelvin Adams wasn't overly concerned about Sumner until last year, when a football player was shot just outside the building and guards had to use mace to break up a gang fight. Adams started looking at all of the numbers.
Academics obviously is primary, but safety is a major, major concern of ours. The Sumner neighborhood has the highest crime rate for incidents of batteries or assaults.
Superintendent Adams wanted to shutter the school at winter break, but that presented a host of logistical problems. So instead, he installed an interim principal, ordered Sumner's students and staff to draft some goals, and gave them an ultimatum. Meet those goals, or the school closes for good in June. By the end of the year, Sumner's average attendance must go from 78% to 85%. The number of suspensions and students failing classes must be cut in half.
We've continued to believe that Sumner is a Sumner that existed 20 and 25 years ago. It is not.
There's extra staff and a new police officer on hand to help, but it's alumni volunteers who seem central to Sumner's attempt to survive. 1963 graduate John Abram was unhappy when Adams first threatened to close Sumner. He wasn't sure the superintendent fully understood the school's legacy. So the retired Ford engineer is making the most of the six-month reprieve by waking up early to help students prepare for the ACT college entrance exam.
I believe that with the benefits of Sumner and his legacy, that those students could get everything that they're looking for right here.
Senior Shannis McCollier found a home at Sumner and is worried about younger students if the school doesn't open next year.
We are comfortable with each other. We are used to each other by now. And if we have to break away and start over again at all those other schools, it will be confrontation.
Like John Abram, Shannis says she isn't blind to Sumner's problems, but she's not sure that the superintendent is being fair.
There is no perfect public high school in St. Louis, but he wants Sumner to shape up and ship right like that.
Adams agrees that Sumner's biggest problems cannot be solved in 6 months. The reprieve is a chance to see what might work at all of the district's struggling high schools. No one expects the Sumner of today to become the academic powerhouse it was 40 years ago. But the numbers are improving enough for cautious optimism that it will at least get a chance to rebuild on the base of that formidable legacy. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Lippman in St. Louis.